point, things are still hanging on a knife edge. Haman, bless him, has met a sticky end, unfortunately. But the law that he passed is still in force. Just because he's no more doesn't mean the Jews are still sitting under threat and their extinction is imminent unless something is done about it. So, Lydia, thank you.
That same day, King Xerxes gave Queen Esther the estate of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came into the presence of the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. The king took off his signet ring, which he had reclaimed from Haman, and presented it to Mordecai, and Esther appointed him over Haman's estate. Esther again pleaded with the king, falling at his feet and weeping. She begged him to put an end to the evil plan of Haman the Agagite, which he had devised against the Jews. Then the king extended his gold scepter to Esther, and she arose and stood before him. "If it pleases the king," she said, "and if he regards me with favour and thinks it's the right thing to do, and if he is pleased with me, let an order be written overruling the dispatches that Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, devised and wrote to destroy the Jews in all of the king's provinces. For how can I bear to see disaster fall on my people? How can I bear to see the destruction of my family?" King Xerxes replied to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, "Because Haman attacked the Jews, I have given his estate to Esther, and they have impaled him on the pole he set up. Now write another decree in the king's name on behalf of the Jews, as seems best to you, and seal it with the king's signet ring, for no document written in the king's name and sealed with his ring can be revoked." The king's edict granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate the armed men of any nationality or province who might attack them and their women and children, and to plunder the property of their enemies. When Mordecai left the king's presence, he was wearing royal garments of blue and white, a large crown of gold, and a purple robe of fine linen, and the city of Susa held a joyous celebration. For the Jews it was a time of happiness, and joy, and gladness, and honour. In every province, in every city, to which the edict of the king came, there was joy and gladness amongst the Jews, with feasting and celebrating, and people of other nationalities became Jews, because fear of the Jews had seized them. On the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the edict commanded by the king was to be carried out. On this day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, but now the tables were turned and the Jews got the upper hand over those who had hated them. The Jews assembled in their cities in all the provinces of King Xerxes to attack those determined to destroy them. No one could stand against them because the people of all the other nationalities were afraid of them. The number of those killed in the citadel of Susa was reported to the king the same day. The king said to Queen Esther, "The Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and 10 sons of Haman in the citadel of Susa. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is your petition? It will be given you. What is your request? It will also be granted." "If it pleases the king," Esther answered, "give the Jews in Susa permission to carry out this day's edict tomorrow also, and let Haman's 10 sons be impaled on poles." So the king commanded that this be done. An edict was issued in Susa, and they impaled the 10 sons of Haman. The Jews in Susa came together on the 14th day of the month of Adar and put to death in Susa 300 men, and they did not lay their hands on the plunder. Meanwhile, the remainder of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also assembled to protect themselves and get relief from their enemies. They killed 75,000 of them, but they did not lay their hands on the plunder. This happened on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th day they rested, and made it a day of feasting and joy.
Kind of feeds into what we're dealing with tonight, which is the final part of the book of Esther. And I think it's nice to have the last part of a series when we have it, because you can sort of look back a bit and pull some threads together and see what's been happening. Really, I think the people of the Jews who were there in Babylon and the rest of the Persian Empire, as it was then, must have wondered really what God was doing, don't you think? I mean, they'd ended up in Babylon and spread throughout the Persian Empire when they took over Babylon, and to do that, they'd been uprooted from their homeland, they'd been taken away from their temple, that had all been destroyed, and I mean, so much devastation had happened to them. And they must have been at a loss to know what all that was about, because after all, they expected things to carry on in Jerusalem forever, really. God was in charge there, and it was his temple, but that was all gone. And now, of course, there was this terrible edict that Haman had passed. And so this other question must have popped into their heads. Well, here we are, far from home. And now there's a threat to exterminate us completely. We've lost so much, and now it looks like we're about to lose everything. But God does move in mysterious ways, doesn't he? And the book of Esther is really picking up that fact. And as we look at it, we can see God at work. In fact, this whole period of the history of the Jews is a fascinating one. It's one we don't often go into, I think. But God was doing some amazing things. Even by the fact that they've been uprooted, they've been put into this foreign land where they're pagan gods everywhere, God actually, over that period of time, got rid of idolatry from the nation of Israel. Now that is a fascinating fact in itself. They had struggled with idol worship ever since the time of Egypt and beyond and past there. So over centuries, generations, it had been a niggling problem. And at some times it had reduced the nation to hardly functioning religiously. The northern tribes had disappeared because of it. And yet God moves them to Babylon, where it's just pagan life and culture. And when they do come through that experience, there is no more idolatry there. Now that's amazing. God moves in mysterious ways. Not only that, there they were, and you gather from what we read there, that there were Jews everywhere all over the Persian kingdom, empire, because the decree that was made was sent out all over the place, because there were Jews in different cities. And all of that really fed into God's plan. Because by taking the Jews away from their temple, he made them have to operate and to worship him and to look to him without all of those trappings, at least for a time. And it's out of that time they spent there that the synagogues began to operate. And the Jews began to live in their communities in different places, and synagogue worship became the order of the day. And it was those synagogues that played a vital role when the gospel eventually went out. People like Paul and others, their first port of call when they went out to evangelize following the resurrection of Jesus was to go to the synagogues and to speak to the Jews, who already had a foundation in their lives from all that God had done in the past with them. And so all that stood in good stead. And as you look back at these things, you can see, well, God is working his purpose out ahead of time. And of course, in this particular story, God is there. And God does, obviously, spare them, as we read. God is at work. And as you look at the book of Esther, I think what Cooper said in the last verse of that seems to relate. He says, blind unbelief is sure to err and scan his work in vain. God is his own interpreter and he will make it plain. So as you look at the book of Esther, which doesn't mention God at all, blind unbelief isn't going to see God there. But actually, the eye of faith does. And we see God there. If nothing else, by the fact that he delivered that people and he enabled them to continue to function and to become the receptacle for the Messiah coming and being the Savior of the world. Now that in itself was something God could not have done that with any other people in this world. Only they had the foundation in their lives. Only they had the truth. Only they had been schooled in the things they needed to be for the time when Jesus came, that his death would be interpreted in the right way. And so he had to save them if he was going to save you and me. That's the upshot of it all. I mean, that in itself is amazing, isn't it? He had to save the Jews at the time of Esther if he was going to save Jesus to save you and me today. But he did. And God is at work. I mean, you just see his hand written all over it in reality, don't you? When you look at this. I was interested just to cast my eye down Proverbs 16. There's some interesting verses in here, which kind of give us a picture of the way God works, the things he does. Verse 5, for instance, of Proverbs 16 says, the Lord detests all the proud of heart. Be sure of this, they will not go unpunished. Well, I mean, that's one of the themes of Esther, isn't it? Dealing with a man who was absolutely eaten up with pride and how God brought him low. Verse 18 as well, pride goes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall. And certainly it did. Verse 9 of that chapter. In his heart man plans his course, but the Lord determines his steps. And that's again what we see in that story. Yes, Haman had his plans, he got his laws passed. But it was God that determined what was going to happen to him in the end. Verse 33. The lot is cast into the lap, but it's every decision is from the Lord. Yeah, I mean, Haman was a superstitious guy. He cast his lots to determine which date to have his extermination of the Jews happen. And as things turned out, it was so far ahead that it gave Esther and Mordecai plenty of time to organize things and to get a counteraction going. And poor old Haman, I mean, what a mistake to make. The lot wasn't in his hands. It wasn't in the hands of whoever he was casting it on behalf of, because it would be some sort of pagan ritual he was doing. The lot was in God's hands to enable that to happen. And verse 4 of that chapter says, the Lord works out everything for his own ends. And again, that's the theme that we've been speaking about. God has done what he's done to bring about his purposes. There are a few sort of little niggles, maybe. I don't know whether you thought anything reading through this passage, but it's not easy in some respects, is it? I mean, all that bloodshed and killing, the fact that they went out. And it tells us in those chapters the thousands that got killed. I mean, that in itself is a troubling thought in itself, isn't it? Was that really all necessary? Where is God in all of that? Those are sort of questions that spring to mind often from people outside of church. I think sometimes we are so familiar with these stories, we can easily gloss over things like that as well. The fact is, there were several things going on here. Was it really necessary for Esther to ask for an extra day so the killing could go on, for instance? How did that fit in to them fulfilling God's purposes? Well, just a few reflections I'll leave you to think about. Anything else you might about this, but one thing is sure, I think, in this story, that there was quite a move of people with animosity towards the Jewish nation. It wasn't just Haman. Haman's law probably wouldn't have achieved very much if there wasn't quite a body of people throughout the empire who were willing to take advantage of it. And certainly Mordecai, he advised Esther, if you remember, to keep quiet about the fact that she was a Jew when she became the queen. Which does suggest that he realized that it might not be political, might not be diplomatic for her to do that because of what other people might do. And so there was a situation. And given the opportunity that Haman provided, there were plenty of people, it seems, ready to take advantage of that. We have to remember too that these are days from before the teaching of Jesus. Jesus refers to the fact that the rabbinical teaching before he came was love your neighbor but hate your enemies. And it would have been no surprise in some respects if some of the Jews at least had operated according to that principle rather than to one of leniency and forgiveness. But against that too, we have to put the fact that the Jews would have seen this, and probably rightly so, as a matter of life and death for them. I think that comes out in a little phrase that keeps repeating itself, that after it tells about the killings that went on, it says, they took no plunder. Now it was in their rights to actually take the possessions of the people that were killed in the process of fulfilling that edict. But it says they took no plunder. In other words, they didn't seek to profit from the death of those people that died in that whole thing. Because I'm sure they saw it simply as a matter of life and death. They were simply seeking to protect their own lives in what they did rather than to profit in some way from what was happening. Well, there's just a few thoughts about it, but the fact is, all this happened. And out of it, the Jewish nation survived. That, as we've said, is the hand of God. And they, in their turn, decided they had a great feast. They enjoyed the moment when it was over and they knew their safety was complete. And as you read on in those chapters, Mordecai and Esther sent instructions out that this was to become a time of feasting and festivity for all time, remembering the great deliverance of the people of Israel. They called it the Feast of Purim. They still keep it today. Purim is simply means the word is lots, because it commemorates the fact that Haman threw his lots and decided that was the day. And that was the day, of course, also became their deliverance day. When they celebrate that feast today, they read the story of Esther and they get very excited about it, as you can imagine, because they saw it a great deliverance. They enter into the drama of it. They really cheer for Mordecai and for Esther and all that's going on. They really jeer and boo for Haman and all the wicked stuff that's happening. And they make a lot of noise. And I don't see any reason why they shouldn't, do you, really? After all, it was a great deliverance. And why not enter into it? Why not enjoy the fact and the moment? And yet, I mean, our deliverance is even greater, isn't it? And I was thinking about that this morning when Marty was speaking about lukewarmness, and I was thinking, yeah. Actually, I read something recently, I think it was John Piper said, it's amazing really how we can say the most earth-shattering things, the most amazing, mind-bending truths about God in such a deadpan fashion. It's true, isn't it? Well, they entered into it and they enjoyed the moment. And I would like us to enjoy the moment because I'm going to just recap the story. And if you want to cheer, I'm very happy for you too. If you want to jeer, that's fine by me. If you want to just sit and listen, that's okay as well, all right? So no pressure. Because this is Esther in poetic form, okay? There was no finer festival the emperor could hold to showcase to a watching world his wealth and power untold, and emphasize the point that he, as Persia's mighty king, was firmly in complete command of every single thing, except, it seems, his lovely queen, who, to his embarrassment, at his call, flatly refused to come to the event. At this, a hasty meeting of the king's top aides advised, depose this queen, and forthwith let her post be advertised, lest wives across this king's domain should suddenly grow bold and think they'll flout their husband's word and not do as they're told. So it was stressed by royal decree. The husband rules his house. And then began the search to find the king a better spouse. Each candidate was soaked in scents until the king assessed her, and from them all he made his choice. The young, attractive Esther. And in due course, his outcome brought a touch of irony. Though husbands had their rule enforced, a wife's role would prove key. Now Haman was a nobleman with ego and ambition, who loved it when the king himself gave him the top position and ordered all the palace staff to bow when he passed by, except that one would not kowtow, a Jew called Mordecai. Ah, Mordecai. There was no guy that Haman hated more, so he by cunning got the king to pass it into law that folk throughout the empire should remove the unsightly blot of Mordecai and all his race and massacre the lot. Now Mordecai implored the queen to block the impending slaughter, for Esther was, though few folk knew, his adopted daughter. It's death to approach the king, she said, without an invitation. What if you were made queen, he said, for such a situation? First, we must hold a 3-day fast, she urged him in reply. Then I will go to see the king. And if I die, I die. It seemed, when she approached the king, things could not be much graver. But he held out his sceptered hand, the sign of royal favour. "I'll give you all you ask," he pledged, "as much as half my realm." Now, offers of such magnitude can simply overwhelm pure motives, even selfless thoughts. But Esther was not thrown. She focused on her people's need and when to make it known. The leopard pounces on his prey. The eagle swoops to snatch. The angler waits with baited hook to entice the unwary catch. But strength and cunning, nerve and speed will not alone prevail. The timing is the vital thing, or everything may fail. And Esther, asked to state her wish, was clear what she must do. First, host a banquet for the king, inviting Haman too. Next, ask them to another one. Smug Haman. He was seen as honoured by the world's top king and favoured by his queen. Of this, he freely boasted. Yet his blue sky had a cloud, the daily sight at the palace gate of Mordecai, unbowed. "Don't get depressed," his wife cajoled, "and do not hang your head. Have gallows built 10 stories high and hang that Jew instead." Convinced he'd get the king's consent, a brightness filled his eyes, expectant at his hated foe's immediate demise. But in the night, in restless mood, devoid of any sleep, the king read royal chronicles instead of counting sheep. 2 men had sought to kill the king. He found it there recorded. And Mordecai had foiled their plot, but never been rewarded. Still reading this when Haman came, he asked, "What should be done for someone whom the king would make a highly honoured one?" Proud Haman's instant thought was this: "It's me he has in mind, and saw the chance to gain the fame for which he'd always pined. Give him a robe, one of the king's, a royal horse provide, assign a prince to herald him, to lead his stately ride, and shout to crowded city streets, 'See, this is what is done for someone whom the king declares a highly honoured one.'" "You sound so keen," the king replied. "It surely must be you to be the one to do all this for Mordecai the Jew." So Haman led the one he loathed in honour through the city, a weary trudge made wearier by envy and self-pity. And when he made it home that day, his grief he could not hide. He dearly wanted TLC for sorely wounded pride. But all his wife could do was say, with her disheartening frown, "If Mordecai is rising up, you'll soon come crashing down." There was no time to reappraise. They whisked him off to dine at Esther's banquet, number 2, with sumptuous food and wine. And there the king pressed Esther, "Ask, what do you want? Be bold." "My life," she said, "as all my race for slaughter have been sold." But when he grasped that Haman had prepared this genocide, the king, consumed with rage, rushed off to clear his thoughts outside. The graph of Haman's life now showed a sharply downward trend, with timely incidents that led to his untimely end. His ego, once so big and bright, now looked distinctly tattered. His nemesis, an orphan girl, made queen just when it mattered. In panic, Haman stooped to beg the queen to spare his life. The king, returning, found him on the couch beside his wife, and in great disbelief exclaimed, "While I'm here in the house, he even has the barefaced nerve to dare molest my spouse." Just then a courtier let it slip that Haman paid to build a gallows for the man who'd saved the king from being killed. Foul Haman faced a furious king whose sentence left no hope, and he who'd sought to pull the strings was hung on his own rope. Sad Haman, shame he did not heed what Jewish scripture said: the scheming of an evil man rebounds on his own head. Haman was gone, but his decree to slaughter Jews was sealed. a law of Medes and Persians that could never be repealed. So Esther took another risk and begged the king afresh. Once more he held the scepter out and granted her wish. To Mordecai he gave his ring and his authority to formulate a rescue plan set in a new decree to give the Jewish people rights that if they faced attack when Haman's law came into force, they could and should fight back. The word went out to India and Egypt and between. And everywhere the day was saved, thanks to a brave young queen whose timely intervention meant the nation could survive, through which at just the ideal time Messiah would arrive. The power and schemes of mortal man might seem invincible, but God may, by the frailest means, unravel them in full. No matter what the race or rank, or in whatever land, the weakness of the trusting soul is strong when in God's hand. I wanted us just to go back over Esther because it's such a fantastic story, isn't it? The hand of God, and yet there is so much to enjoy in the story of Esther. There's so much humour there. I mean, let's face it, Psalm 2 says that God laughs at those who try to oppose him, and especially try to oppose the fact of him putting his son into position. And Esther is so shot through with so many humorous incidents. But there is so much here too to look at. And just briefly, Esther raises three great things to us. The first question it seems to ask is, who's in charge here? Who's in charge? Candidate number one is Xerxes, the great king, the emperor. Arguably the most powerful man on the planet at this stage. But oh, yes, a man who, showing off everything, could suddenly be refused by a mere woman. And he's thrown into consternation, isn't he? He has to gather his aides around him to make a vital decision, because this is going to send shockwaves through his kingdom. And Xerxes is in a flap. He's a bit of a bumbler, really. He doesn't hold power that easily. He's all too ready to hand it over to Haman and let Haman call the shots. And he's not very discerning about other people either, is he? Because he would never have picked Haman to do his work if he'd realized what sort of person he was. Candidate number two is Haman himself, isn't it? The rising star. Yet a man eaten up, power hungry, self-obsessed. And in his hands, power is something you put to personal ends. And so he can't cope with Mordecai, can he? Because you suspect, actually, for all that Haman thinks of himself, there's a niggle of doubt in his own heart that he is what he thinks he is. And Mordecai is the thorn in his flesh who reminds him that actually he's quite human. And he can't cope with Mordecai. And he makes a huge miscalculation, mostly because he doesn't know all the facts. He doesn't realize that Esther belongs to the very tribe that he's trying to eradicate. And so Haman comes to his end. And he's brought down. But they're perfect foils, aren't they, in this story, for the one who is truly in charge. It's not Esther or Mordecai. They were simply serving their nation, serving the God effectively in charge of their nation. God is the one that rules. And that's what the story reminds us. He's the one in charge, and it's no better thought, no greater thing to hold on to, is it, really and truly, in this time that we live in? This tumult that we're in politically. You wonder who's in charge, don't you? You think, please, even the things that we thought should happen don't happen anymore like they used to. But ultimately, God is the one. What he wants, what he determines is carried out. So, God's in charge. Second thing that it says very much to us is that weakness in God's hands is sheer strength, isn't it? I don't know how you feel about what you're able to achieve, but that's not really the issue. I don't think Esther thought she could achieve much at the beginning. She was inexperienced, she was young, and yet God was able to use her. She simply had to be patient, wait for the right time, just move forward slowly. It wasn't some great and fantastic thing. Yes, she put her life on the line at one point. But when things started to happen, she just had to provide the situation of the banquet. And then things started to happen and all began to unravel for poor old Haman and his scheme. Weakness in God's hand is strength. But the important thing is knowing our own weakness, isn't it? Being convinced of it. Otherwise we're inclined to run ahead or inclined to try and do something that we're not intended to do. Knowing your own weakness is the most powerful thing in your favour when you come to working with God. Knowing your own weakness. And then predominantly over all of this is the fact that God is faithful. He is faithful to his people. And the fact that the Old Testament so clearly reminds us, doesn't it, of God's faithfulness to his old covenant people is a constant reminder to us, isn't it? That same faithfulness, that same dogged determination that he has to stay true to his covenant, that is the same God who works with us according to his new covenant. And we are his people. And what the Old Testament teaches us about how he regarded that covenant in the old days, it teaches us about how he operates today in relation to you and me. And that too is something to grasp hold of. A God who stays true to his people. A God who stays true to his purposes. He is not going to let all those years of investment and all of that planning from before the foundation of the world go astray through what happens in the Persian Empire. And nor is he going to let it go astray. That plan that we read about earlier spans from before the beginning of the world to after the end of the world. And he who's begun a good work will finish it. And so his faithfulness to his purposes and the fact that he will see them through, come what may. I don't know whether Boris can keep that. But I know that God will. God is faithful. His people, his purposes, and also his word. Remember what he said to Abraham? In your seed shall all the nations of the world be blessed. And if the Jews' nation had come to an end, that would never have been fulfilled. But God stands by his word. And so we can trust him. As we go to him and look at what he says, as we take his own word back to him, as it's always a good thing to do, we know that he stands by that. And those are truths, aren't they, to hold on to, especially when we sense that God is moving in mysterious ways in our lives and all around us. Let's pray.